Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
All right, we were talking about benzodiazepines and barbiturates last time. We know for sure that there's birth defects from barbiturates, wide range of them, probably for benzodiazepines. Newborns go through withdrawal, as I mentioned, so someone who's taking, a pregnant mother who's taking the drug because it crosses the blood-brain barrier, sorry, the placental barrier, you're going to get a kid born going through withdrawal. While that's not very pleasant, the sort of calculus that an MD has to go through is, do you need these drugs to the mother? Do you need them to live, basically, right? So let's say you have somebody who's taking them as like an anti-seizure medication. Well, they can't be having seizures. So what happens is the kid's born, goes through the withdrawal, and in a few days, okay, right? It's not a great thing to do, but it's better than actually, you know, losing the baby because the mother dies. Let's put it that way. There are demasculinizing effects where little boys don't end up, basically the Müllerian duct doesn't close shut, right? So you don't end up, if you, those of you that have ever looked at a scrotum will realize there's a seam down there, and the seam's there because we all start out with the same anatomy. We all look like girls, and then the opening closes up for little boys, right? So sometimes this doesn't happen with when pregnant mothers take these drugs in larger amounts. They can lead to aggression and violence in people that take them, and that's because of the sort of disinhibiting effect that we've talked about with alcohol. The lethal dose shows no tolerance, which is pretty typical, but the effective dose really does, and it shows rather rapid tolerance. So the more you take these drugs, the more likely you are to end up overdosing and killing yourself. It's not a good thing. You'll see lethal doses change sometimes for people that are chronic users in other drugs, but not with these. And, of course, therefore, you can overdose. Treatments. First thing you have to do is get through withdrawal. That's pretty common where, of course, that's not part of treatment, but you have to get through the withdrawal before anybody can get into treatment. That's the, quote, detoxing sort of system, right? So, basically, you go somewhere or you, on your own, stop taking the drug and go through withdrawal, which is unpleasant. This should usually be done under a physician's care. This is typically with these things, it's the best case scenario is to do it under a physician's care, perhaps in a hospital or in some sort of facility. Doing it on your own could be dangerous. But 12-step programs that are based on Alcoholics Anonymous, that model, these are used a lot in all kinds of different drugs, everything from cocaine to alcohol. So they've had some success. The contracting approach, which I talked about with alcohol, is really kind of neat because it's kind of a behavioral approach where what you do is you have someone who's got a problem with these drugs and you say, look, what I'm going to do, you're going to sign this thing and I'm going to be able to give you drug tests. And if you don't have clean urine someday, I'm going to tell your mother. I'm going to tell your boss. I'm going to tell your spouse or your kids. And actually, that's a pretty good incentive. Because people don't want, typically, other people to know that they have a drug problem, right? So it's actually been pretty successful. The problem with getting treatment for any drug that's being used illegally is people have to admit they're committing a crime, right? See, drinking too much, it may be stupid, but it's not a crime. You're not using alcohol illegally, you're just using too much alcohol. If you're taking these drugs recreationally, you go get a prescription. You're doing it under false pretenses, right? You shouldn't be doing this. So now you have to go to get treatment. You have to first of all go admit to someone that you've done something that's not socially desirable, right? It's not a thing that you walk into a doctor's office. Typically, it's harder for people to walk in and say, "I got a problem with prescription, you know, tranquilizers." Going into a doctor's office and saying, I got to quit smoking, doc. Or, I drink too much. I want to slow down. That's something people can do. It's not fun to do, but it's a lot easier because you don't have to also throw in the, oh, yeah, and that makes me a criminal, actually, and I've been really screwing you around with all those prescriptions I'm getting you to write me. It's not good. So it's also then hard to get data on how effective a lot of these treatment programs are, because again, you've got people then, when they're getting studied, admitting they're criminals. Right? So that's sort of a running theme we'll have, that a lot of times with the treatment programs for a lot of these drugs, it's very hard to know what the effectiveness rate is. And of course, people don't want to share these things with others. You know, it's not something that you're exceedingly proud of anyway. And you might want to keep it quiet. And of course, if you're under physician's care, they have to be confidential anyway. So that was the benzodiazepines. This is the most depressing lecture you will ever have given to you, except if you take some course about, like, World War II. Because this is really depressing. This is certainly the most depressing one we'll have in this class, for a number of reasons. Okay. Talk about inhalants. As I said, this is depressing. Talking about people sniffing and huffing solvents, paint, nail polish remover, gasoline, lighter fluid, PAM. Back in the day, it used to have a propellant in it, you know, like that non-sprick stick spray, or non-sprick stay, which is a whole other thing. You fill it, I don't even know what it means. Basically, you know, sniffing glue is what I'm talking about here. Okay? And gasoline. This is an interesting story. I hardly ever blame the media for anything because I hate when people blame the media. It just bugs me. I think it's the media's fault. I blame the media blamers, typically. However, it's interesting that there was a subculture of people sniffing glue and sniffing solvents of various kinds. And there was an article in the late 1950s in, I believe it was Life magazine, where they talked about glue sniffing. And then the cops talked about glue sniffing after reading this article. And this was in sort of inner cities in the States, really poor parts of cities in the States. And what ended up happening was then people found out they could sniff glue. It looks like the increase in glue sniffing in the 50s happened as a response. People said, oh, really? I can get high doing that? And they started doing it. Sort of a strange thing. I will say, these kind of things, I think many of us have had experiences where mistakenly, we've sniffed solvents, right? If you ever used contact cement, and I mean the good stuff, not the stuff that's non-toxic, that doesn't actually glue anything together, but that green goo that you have to let dry, and you put, you know, or strapping glue, things like that. Or if you make model airplanes, yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, model airplanes, you end up kind of loopy when you're making a plane. So many of us have had, it feels kind of like being drunk. So there is something to this, obviously. The same thing happened with aerosols, by the way, in the 1970s, the idea of sniffing the propellant in PAM, things like that. So spraying it into a bag, and then you end up with basically something similar to, well, the propellant in there was something that had psychoactive properties in it. Not so much anymore. So the same thing happened then in the 70s. Of course, now we hear a lot about gasoline, and we know it's a real problem. Now, you have to understand something. It's a problem. It's a small number of people. But in the places where it's a problem, it's a big amount of people. So it's a small number of people in the grand scheme of things, but in certain places, it's like everybody. So it's a weird kind of... It's a weird drug that way, the way this is used, is that... It's only, and it tends to be, basically, really poor people. Or really poor isolated people. It isn't just isolation, though. We think about that in Canada. But in the States, it tends to be in inner cities where people are isolated, maybe you might want to say societally. But they might live downtown in Detroit. So we tend to think of, typically, First Nations communities in Canada, typically very far north. But that's not the only set of people that it's affecting. In Canada, that's mostly who it's affecting. And that's gas sniffing. How do you do this? There's a depressing picture. How old do you think that little boy is? How old is that kid? Five? I lifted that picture from the CBC website. I figure they're not going to sue me because I pay taxes or something. So I'll freely admit that I stole that from the CBC. In a very small way, I had paid for that photo. That's a photo from Davis Inlet in Labrador. And that's like a 4.5 or 5-year-old kid's huffing gasoline. Okay? So just a way to demonstrate how this is done. You can sniff it or you can do what this kid's doing. It's called huffing. He's put gasoline in a garbage bag. And he's like that. Okay? And if that picture doesn't break your heart, you're not a human. Yeah, sometimes swallowing happens, not on purpose. Not on purpose. And these bags, by the way, if you've ever seen this, that's a green garbage bag. So that's down right around the kid's feet because he's a little kid. And they put just not very much gas in there. See, it's cheap, eh? That's the other thing you got to realize about this. Why is it poor people? It's cheap. You might say, gas is expensive. Yeah, you don't need much gas to do this. One of the things that people will do is also put a cloth over their face, a wet cloth, and then huff it. It makes sure that you get some fresh air and not just gasoline. It's like a filter. Putting it in a bag, of course, concentrates it. Now, that's why, for example, if you've ever done, I remember putting a hardwood floor in our basement in London when I was about 12 years old, and before we put the floor down, the hardwood floor, we had to put down a subfloor because you can't just put hardwood floor on top of concrete. I guess you could. That would make you a bit of an idiot. So we put down, you had to put down these 2x2s, okay? And you use this stuff called strapping glue, so which is kind of like the same thing as contact cement, except I believe it was orange colored. And Dad and I were putting these things down, and you paint the stuff on the floor, and then you paint it on the wood, you let it dry, and then you stick it down. You better get it right because it's stuck forever. And we were putting this down, and it was one night, and I swear, Dad and I, we did it for like 2 hours. And you're sitting there waiting, and we're idiots, of course, so we're sitting there waiting in the basement to wait for the things to dry so we can glue them down, and the two of us were completely loopy. You know, at the end of it, like, we came upstairs, and like, we're walking like this, and Mom's like, what's wrong with you guys? Oh, we were just putting in a floor. Yeah, it's good times. Yeah, it was great. You know, so it was a bad scene. Now that, of course, isn't nearly as concentrated, and many of you have probably had this thing where you've, like I said, you paint thinners, there's all kinds of things that give you a little bit of a buzz, you know, but if you put it all in a bag, it's going to concentrate the vapors, right? And that's why, of course, they're putting it in the bag. You can also do it directly from an aerosol can, or from an aerosol can, the aerosol cans don't tend to work this way anymore so much, but you can spray it into a baggie of some sort, like a little Ziploc bag or something like that. Because it's the propellant that you're sucking on there. You're not actually trying to suck on Pam. Right? Isn't he all dressed? He looks so nice all dressed up. All right. Basically, as you would imagine, these things are absorbed into the lungs. And they're quickly passed to the brain as things that are absorbed into the lungs are. The blood just brings it right up to the brain. What happens here is the concentration in the blood approaches the concentration in the air. So for those of you sort of science-y minded, that's how the world pretty much works when there's no barrier, right? Things try to get equal concentrations. So this is what ends up happening. And this is why you can get very high very quickly, but then you can put it away and not be really, really high pretty quickly too, because then it goes back the other way. You actually end up breathing out gasoline. It's highly lipid-soluble, so it's going to reach your brain quickly because it's pretty fatty, and your liver because it's pretty fatty. Yeah, Steph?
Highly lipid-soluble things stay in your fat. As well.
Yeah, it does for a time, and this is perhaps one of the reasons that it can lead to things like birth defects, that it ends up just staying in fat cells. It doesn't have any effect anymore, psychological isn't the word I'm looking for, behaviorally, okay, so you're not high anymore, but there's still actually maybe things like toluene or gasoline sitting in there, yeah. Which here is going to cause damage, and here is going to cause damage.
Does it cause damage in the lungs as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just a given. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. For sure. Yeah, I mean, the whole, you know, and you get all, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you've ever played with any of this stuff, it's they're volatile chemicals. They're not fun things to be around in general. So the concentrations drop quickly, again, because of this sort of diffusion thing where you're getting it out very quickly and the concentration in the air then, the concentration in the blood ends up meeting the concentration in the air pretty quickly because you breathe it out through the lungs. If your heart's beating faster, you will get greater reduction, so it'll go out more quickly, again, because the blood's bringing it back to the lungs and you breathe it out more quickly. Toluene, which is the smell of toluene, it's the smell of contact cement. Okay, if you've ever smelled contact cement or magic markers, you know, good magic markers, the ones that you sniff, right? Or remember, most of you probably don't. When I was a kid, teachers would hand out stuff made on what was called a ditto machine, not a copying machine. And it had this kind of smell to it, and that's toluene as well. So you'd get that, and everybody would sniff them, yeah. Because even like at the age of two, like grade two, you got a little high from it, and everybody in class is smelling them. Yeah, you smell the paper. I mean, in that case, it wasn't dangerous. It wasn't enough that it could do anything bad to you. I always wondered about those ditto machines, though. They must have been a lot of people hanging out by them. And the liver also creates metabolites that may be toxic. We don't know a lot about this. There's a couple of reasons. The first reason, and the biggest reason, is that these are isolated communities of people. And because a lot of times you have people that, because they're isolated and poor, they don't tend to trust rich people that aren't educated rich people that are showing up to do research. It's hard to trust them. Okay? The first case, it's probably as long as the stuff's been around. It was in the 1950s, when people started really looking at when it became a, quote, epidemic. And that was the idea of glue sniffing, right? You know, airplane glue. Humans will do anything to get high. It doesn't matter what the drug is. They'll find some way. And if you got rid of all drugs, people would be, you know, sitting in a swivel chair spinning around as fast as they could. I mean, this is just something we do. Benzyl alcohol, for example, is something, one of the metabolites that's created from toluene, and that's really horrible. You drink a glass of that, you might kill yourself. Just like wood alcohol, things like that. So these are really not good things. No, that's methyl alcohol. All right. Whoa. Okay, the neurophysiology, we aren't really entirely sure. There's been some stuff done with animals. Not a lot, but there's been some. Nobody's entirely sure how. And of course, it's a wide range of things. The effects themselves are similar to alcohol and barbiturates, benzodiazepines, in that people get, it slows you down. So that makes you think probably it enhances GABA, and some of the animal data show that for sure. Glycine as well. It attenuates, in other words, slows down, the NMDA receptor for glutamate. Now, NMDA is a neuromodulator. Okay, so NMDA is a neuromodulator, and it makes neurons fire faster. So this now stops the NMDA receptor for glutamate from firing. Glutamate's excitatory, so it's inhibitory. So it's a very roundabout way of doing it. Doing it on GABA is much more direct, but it's the same kind of effect. It seems that it affects dopamine and mesolimbic dopamine system. That shouldn't surprise you, because that's the reward system. We're not really sure how. No one's really sure how. No one really knows. And again, you've got a wide range of different substances here as well. Yes, Stephanie?
What's the effect of glycine?
Glycine is also usually inhibitory. Yep. Yeah, not again. I've never told you that before. I probably should have told you that. I don't think I have. Behavioral looks like somebody's drunk when they're sniffing gas. People can hallucinate, so that's a little bit different because usually it takes really large amounts of alcohol to hallucinate. That's usually more of a withdrawal symptom. People can seize. Seizure, right? Seizure, she's right over there. Trying to lighten it up. This is depressing. People have what's called a stupor. You know, like, you know, you've heard people put the word drunken stupor. So it's, you know, you don't really know where you're going and you're walking like this and you're kind of half blacked out. That's what I'm talking about there. From gas sniffing. Yeah. So you end up with the inability to speak properly. It's the, when people look really drunk, it's the same kind of thing. It can kill you. Because most of these things are actually also poisons. When you look on the side of a jar of, or a can of contact cement or a little thing of the glue we give our children to put airplanes together. I have a whole bunch at home, too. I used to make model planes all the time. Then I had a little son who used to wreck them, so I stopped making model planes. I still have all these paints at home. I still have like 3 kits to make. I get the little paints, and I get the glue. And if you look on the side of the glue, there's one of them skull and crossbones it's saying, don't inhale this. And, of course, I always had thinners, I had all this stuff, and I thought, I don't think I should have this around the boy. So I still have it all, because the stuff will kill you. I'm being sarcastic here. Yeah, it probably impairs driving. A good guess would be huffing gasoline and driving don't mix. I will say, by the way, it's interesting about this topic. The first time I used the McKim book was 1998, first time I taught this class, was 1998, and there was no mention of this at all. 2 editions ago, or 1 edition ago, there was suddenly a chapter on inhalants because it had become much more in the news media. I think partially, McKim is actually at Murray University of Newfoundland, and this is a serious thing. It's serious anywhere, but it's known quite a bit in remote areas of the province of Newfoundland and Labrador. I mentioned Davis Inlet. All right. More effects. Probably tolerance. Again, this is a hard thing to study for a lot of reasons. We're not really sure, but probably it makes some sense. Probably withdrawal, sort of hangover-y. It seems to be able to lead to psychotic-like behavior, so that's paranoia, that kind of thing. Not reality testing. So you don't actually know the difference between what's real and what's just your sort of hallucinations, your delusions, right? Probably leads to liver and kidney cancer. May lead to brain cancer. There's been talk about that. Nothing really very solid on that. It's more like people think it might. But I actually looked very closely into this when my dad had a brain tumor, because my dad worked with this kind of glue that, like most of those adhesives, those industrial adhesives, it glued mid-flight cases, you know, for bands that carry their gear in, and it has this foam in it, and the foam is glued to the inside of these, and the way that works, that glue is actually melts the foam, and then it sticks right on the, and we always had it around, so I went, ooh, I wonder if that is what did it, and, you know, looked it up, couldn't find anything except some people mentioning the same kind of thing. Well, I know a guy, and I know a guy isn't good enough. But it wouldn't surprise me, considering fatty tissue in brain, etc. So kidney and liver damage as well. Is there something called fetal solvent syndrome? Good question. How do we parse these apart is the problem, because most of the places where people are huffing gasoline, there's also a real alcohol problem. So kids are born with fetal alcohol syndrome. Now, you got to then wonder how much is it the alcohol doing that, and how much is it was it because mom was huffing gas. It wouldn't surprise anybody, I don't think, but that's why there's a question mark here, because you can't parse the two apart, because in almost all these places where this is happening, there's also a really serious alcohol problem. You can overdose so you can kill yourself. I think I had death before, so just trying to reiterate. It can kill you. Don't do it. All right. This is where it gets even more depressing, because how do we, and this is where I'm willing to listen to ideas, because no one has an idea. Well, people have ideas, they just don't work. How do we stop people from starting, and how do we treat people that are doing this? Well, some things have been tried, putting nasty additives and stuff. The book mentions this, I think. Things that are unpalatable. So, for example, you take gasoline and you put, or something else like that, and you put something that smells so horrible no one's going to sniff it. You put like sulfur dioxide in it, right? So it smells like rotten eggs. Or you fill it full of capsaicin, so what ends up happening is that it's red hot, it burns the inside of your nose, and you just don't want to do it again because it burns you, the stuff from hot peppers. That's not very effective, because for most people, these are just, or sensible even really, because for most people, most of us use these substances daily, and we use them responsibly. Would you want to have to put on, like, a special breathing apparatus when you put gas in your car? No. Right? Would you want construction workers? Would they have to, you know, when they're using contact cement and this kind of stuff? No. They have to wear, supposed to wear masks and stuff, but, you know, you wouldn't want to go a whole lot further than that. So it's not really practical. Yeah, education. Here's one. I love when people say this. All we have to do is explain to these native people they shouldn't huff gasoline. Yeah, like they don't know that. They're not stupid. They know it's not good for them. Right? I love that. Education. All we need is an education program. Hey, don't huff gasoline. They look at you and go, really? Is it bad for me? They're not dumb. So I really find this patronizing and annoying. This has been tried, by the way. And it's best of intentions. No one's, you know, thinking, oh, they're all stupid. It sort of implies that, though. But yeah, I mean, you'd think they don't know. So telling people it's bad for them, telling people it's going to hurt them, telling people all these things, they know that. Because when this does happen, it ends up usually, again, in an isolated place, and it ends up the whole town does it. Like a lot of people. They know it's not good. So that's not going to work. Why are people doing this in the first place? Now, let's look at where they do it. People do it that are really poor, tend to be isolated, either sort of societally isolated or geographically and societally. I don't know how to keep not being able to say that. Isolated. Right? This is something that happens to people that have no prospects, no hope. Right? You don't see a lot. There's no problem with that here in Sault Ste. Marie, is there? Are there people? Probably. There's 75,000 people living here. There's probably somebody huffing gas right now in town. But it's not like we hear about it all over the place. It's a huge thing. We hear about it in these remote communities. There's a lot of other problems in those places. You know, 40 and 50% unemployment rates. Those are bad. People have no prospects, right? So there's all kinds of potential reasons why people, and there's one place, though, you can get something good. Oh, you can put some gas in a bag and huff it. It'll feel good. It'll feel good. What are you going to do in these places? Ban gasoline? Of course not. That's stupid. You can't ban gas. People need it to get around. You know, I mean, again, so there's no way you can do that. So you've got to treat... It's almost like you have to treat a whole place, not just some people. And that's unlike a lot of other drugs where people may be having a rough time, but it's not everybody around them is doing the same thing. This can often take many attempts. There's been a lot of things that have been tried. When I lived in Newfoundland, it was happening. That picture, as I said, was from Davis Inlet. And one of the things they did is they took the kids from there. The province went and just took them because they said, look, their parents are huffing gasoline and so are the children. The children need to get away and have a little bit of normal life for a while, and then they'll go back and they'll be okay. Best of intentions, right? This is the idea. We'll get them into school because they weren't going to school because they're too busy huffing gasoline, and their parents weren't because they were huffing gasoline. Oh, okay. So we'll get them in school. They'll end up meeting some other people. It all sounds nice. So they took all these kids, and they took them to St. John's. Now, you got to understand something. I know St. John's, to most people in the world, is a small place. It's got about 200,000 people. So it's not a big city. It's a big city if you come from a remote town of a couple of hundred people. It's also, like all the rest of Newfoundland, overwhelmingly white. It's the whitest place you've ever seen. Well, not St. John's. Most of Newfoundland is, though. So, culture shock. You've got kids being taken from their folks. That can't be fun. You got kids going from a place where they're no longer... They're a very small minority culture now. And you've also got kids that... They've never been to a place that has thousands of people in it. They took them to St. John's. A lot of the kids, they're kids. So, you know, they end up going to school. They got some problems, but they're doing a little bit better. They send them back, and they're back doing this. Right? I remember when they showed this, the province was, people didn't know what to do. This was discussed like crazy all the time on the news and on, you know, people were talking about it on the almost, you know, you'd run into people in the store, you'd hear people talking about it because it was a real problem. People knew it. And so of course there's a lot of media coverage. When the kids came off the plane and then they got on a little bus and they took them down to this gym where they're going to go meet with the families they were going to stay with. And I remember this kid, and he was probably 6. And to show you how different their lives were to the lives of the people they were going to go live with, the kid got off the bus and looked at a cameraman and said, "You got a fucking cigarette, man?" And you think about something like that, I mean, that's quite a bit bigger than, oh, he comes from a, no, doesn't come from a good family. Dare I say, those kids would probably have a lot more trouble adjusting than kids that are moving here from Haiti because of the earthquake. So, and then he'd send them back and they do it again. See? She knows. So, what are you going to do? You can. They know it's bad for them. They're not stupid. People want... There were some parents that were very angry with this because, of course, their kids are being taken. But there were a lot of other parents that said, "Yeah, God, fix my kid." And it looked, you know, mildly successful. They go back. They're doing it again. So the question I have, and that's what I told you, this is short and depressing, is what do we do? I think it's about reinforcement, right? So it's about getting something good in your life, isn't it? Right? And you know, you can only, there's very little prospects in a place that's literally in the middle of nowhere. Being an isolated place in Labrador is literally, I believe, being in the middle of nowhere. So you got that. How in the hell can you deal with such a thing? How is it even possible to fix this? Things that have been tried. They've also taken, like, the community of Sheshachit was completely just bulldozed. Which people thought it was okay. It wasn't like they showed up one day. And they said, we're going to build you a brand new place. We're going to put... You get brand new houses, you get better housing, all this stuff. This was all tried. And these problems continue. They move the town, they build them all brand new buildings, everything. Same thing happens. It seems to me almost what has to happen is you've got to treat, like I said, a whole town. What's the problem here? Who's going to show up? You've got to think about sort of cultural sensitivity here, right? So you got whatever the people may be. In those cases, they were Dene people. Some social worker from St. John's or Cornerbrook going to show up? Probably not going to be trusted. Probably maybe shouldn't be. I mean, in the past, for sure, and perhaps now, good reason not to trust them. You might say, okay, well, then someone from the local community. Problem is, a person from the local community has to go out, go to school, learn how to do all this stuff. That takes a lot of time. Right? That takes a lot of time. You can't just go take somebody and make them into a therapist, like for a 2-week course. They got to go away to school for a long time. And where do they got to go away to school? They got to go away to school in places that are big cities that have enough culture shock with them anyway. You know? I mean, I have a little bit of hope for people around here because of the large Native student population here that maybe some people will go on and do that kind of stuff. But, I mean, still, that takes years and then graduate school and all that kind of stuff. Not going to happen overnight. I don't know what this... Does anybody have any idea? Because we could sell it to the government and make millions.
Integration,
how so? Sure. Well, and part of it is, I mean... Part of me thinks that might be sensible. The problem is that...
Lose our way of life.
Yeah. Which, and of course, the other end of it is, well, the genie's out of the bottle anyway. Maybe the way of life's lost. But that's not something I think that... I don't think that's a tenable solution. It might work, but then it would probably cause all kinds of other problems. And I don't want to put too fine a point on this. We sort of tried that already. Why this building's here. Now, I know you're not suggesting using a residential school system. I'm pretty sure you're not, you know, but there's not a really good history there, right? And plus, it's their culture. We let people all over the country live in their own culture and stuff like that. So you can't, it'd be hard to force people, you know. So in the best of all possible worlds, if people didn't care at all about their own cultures, like if no one did, then it'd probably be fine. But the problem is, humans have these cultures, right? So I think, and I think you're right, that might, over a very long period, work, but I can't see it. Well, yeah, I mean, you've got to, that's it. You've got to give people their defined reinforcement in life. It's pretty hard where those folks are living to ever feel good. Because there's no prospects, there's nothing. You know, what do we do? I mean, yeah, you give them back their dignity, but they also have to... So in that case, then, they would be able to get reinforcement from something else in life. And that's, again, that's a societal thing. That's not an individual. Are there other thoughts? Do you have any plans? I still haven't come up with one. I got nothing. I got things that might take, you know, oh, forever. You know, you can't ban stuff. Because these are things that are needed, especially in isolated places where people have to do things like buy skidoo and boat. They kind of need gasoline, right? And in some of these places, I remember in Sheshachit, they tried, in Labrador, they tried banning alcohol, which even made the gas huffing worse. Because, of course, then there's nothing else, like, you know, at least you can get... a drink. Yeah, please, sir. No, send it to your hand up.
Well, when I think of like an isolated community, I think of a place where there's not many things to do.
Yeah.
So maybe like bringing in more activities, like
activities for the kids to do.
That's one of the things that one of the things they've tried when they've rebuilt some of these communities is they've tried to set up, you know, community centers and activities for the kids. One of the problems there, again, is that what activities do? You have to be kind of culturally sensitive. These are people that are much different than people that live in the southern part of the country. And I'm including, yes, I know we live in northern Ontario, but I mean, you know, they live in this part of the world. So what kind of things do you set up? What kind of things do you do? And how do you pay for this? I mean, that's the other end of it. And it is the responsibility, technically, of the federal government to pay for things like that. That's the way those things work, right? But if you're going to set up, what would we think of, you know, if we were thinking of somewhere around here? We'd say, well, let's get the kids, we'll give them hockey equipment, we'll make them a rink. Who are they going to play against? Right? These are really, I don't think any of us here can imagine how isolated some of these places are. You know, literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away from anybody. Right? So that kind of thing, sure. I think community involvement like that and getting people to do stuff, but the money has to come from somewhere. Of course, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what we spend on almost anything, but when people hear that something's going to cost $25 million to do, people don't want to do it. And we live in a country where the government responds supposedly to the people now and then. So, you know. But yeah, again, that kind of thing. I think everybody's on the same sort of page. We have to treat society. Yeah, Stephanie, any ideas?
So mostly Aboriginal communities.
They are in Canada. It isn't in the States. It's in the States. It's isolated Latinos, a Latino community, but they're not isolated far away. They're isolated in inner cities.
So for Canada?
Yes.
Obviously, each community can have a slightly different approach.
Yep, I think so.
Are they still mainly, like, how do they sustain themselves? Do they get grocery shipped into them? Or?
A lot of places do, and, of course, there's also a lot of hunting and fishing and stuff like that.
Okay. So they're culturally, traditionally hunter-gatherer style.
Yeah.
And so now they've kind of digressed from that.
Well, and see, this is the thing. A lot of people say that. If people go back to living their traditional way of life, you're saying give them back their dignity. The problem is you've got the genie out of the bottle. So you can't, for example, what are you going to tell people? Hey, no more satellite TV and internet.
Yeah.
And that's not fair to them because they want that too. And they shouldn't. Why should we have it? And they don't. But yeah, some of them, depending on the place, yeah, it tends. These tend to be communities that, you know, have stores in them and stuff like that. Yeah, for sure. Oh, that's where they get the gasoline at the gas station. You know, yeah. It's heartbreaking, and I'm not one to say it's anybody's fault. I don't know. Who cares whose fault it is at this point? Just fix it, right? But it's such a big thing to try to fix. You know, and that's why I've always said I think nobody should ever have culture. Nobody. Nobody should be. We should all be like humans. We should be like Star Trek. We have the human culture, and everything would be fine. But until Captain Kirk shows up, and we get beyond all these things, and I don't think a lot of people would find that a satisfactory solution anyway. Yeah, I don't know. So it's depressing and sad. And I don't know what to do. You know. Isn't it horrible? I don't know. I'm sure I've ruined your day, Ollie. It sucks. If you do come up with any ideas, let me know, because I'd love something that I think could work. Because I wouldn't sell it for a lot. Like, we'd split the money between all of us. We'll call some ministry or something. We can fix that whole problem there. Like I said, I think I have some hope in that a place like this, a school like this, where there's so many Aboriginal people going to school here, there's a possibility of a generation of people coming through that are going to be doing all kinds of different psychology or whatever degrees, and perhaps they can tackle some of these problems. You know? That's enough. I'm depressed. Let's go.
I lie below. You float above. In the pretty white ships that I've been dreaming of. swim beside you, getting dizzy in your wake, getting close enough to touch you, getting brave enough to take you into my arms, bring you down to be with me. But I can't do that thing anymore. I can't be the thing I was before. Maybe I am better off alone, because I crush everything and I crush everything and I crush everything. My body's strong, my will is weak. Got pretty nice arms, but I hate my beak. And the dolphins are all phonies. They seem nice enough at first, but they pretend to be your friend until they see you at your worst. And then they leave you without a word. They swim away. So I can't do that thing anymore. I can't be the thing I was before. Maybe I am better off alone, because I crush everything and I crush everything and I crush everything. And everything I want, I take. And everything I love, I bring. Every night I lie awake. Did the stars come out? Did the world spin round? Does it matter that much when you're 10 miles down? In the light that filters down into my giant yellow eye, I can see the sails unfolding, stretching wide against the sky. And I forgive them, I forgive, and I let go. 'Cause I can't do that thing anymore. I can't be the thing I was before. Maybe I am better off alone, because I crush everything and I crush everything and I crush everything.
Podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, Sharealike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.